So welcome to Food Conversation Season 8. And before we begin, we cannot forget that we live and work in Skwepakulu, the ancestral, unceded, and actually stolen lands of the Skwepmik people. Every day it becomes clearer that doing the best we can to resolve this historical injustice is a critical responsibility for us all. Now today, Tom and I have the pleasure of welcoming into the studio not one but eight guests. And on this particular day, having them on Zoom has certainly helped us with studio logistics. Our eight guests are members of Growing Sustainable Physicians, part of a long overdue and wonderful process of renewal, reigniting the ancient professional relationship between food and healing. Now, this group, Growing Sustainable Physicians, is a potpourri of health professionals, predominantly family physicians, but with an important seasoning of other health professionals. And they act collectively to bring together the issues of food and human and planetary health. Now, Growing Sustainable Physicians is based in various parts of Southern Ontario. It's an offshoot of a 30-year-old organization called the Canadian Association of Physicians for the Environment, which was initiated by three doctors, one of whom, I am happy to say, is yours truly. Over the years, this organization has grown and now has representation throughout Canada, including an active wing called Cape Ontario. Cape Ontario has a subsection called the Agri-Food Interest Group, from which Growing Sustainable Physicians has developed. So welcome everyone to Food Conversations.
Hello.
Thank you.
I am Tasha Lake, and I am a PhD candidate in public health at the University of Waterloo.
Dr. Barry Bruce, physician.
I'm Dr. Tila Johnson, and I'm a hospitalist.
I'm Serena. I'm a third-year medical student from the University of Toronto.
I'm Valerie Palda, and I'm a general internist at St. Michael's Hospital at the University of Toronto.
I'm Brent Elsie, a retired family physician now in Waterloo.
I'm David Rosen. I'm a retired family physician living in Mississauga.
Now, the coordinator for Growing Sustainable Physicians and the inspiration for its formation is Dr. Valerie Palda. Valerie is an internal medicine specialist who works particularly in the area of cancer treatment, among many other activities. So Valerie, in just a few words, how would you characterize the purpose and function of Growing Sustainable Physicians? What's it really about?
Well, when we were talking as a group about what we wanted to do to improve our planetary health and match that with improving the health of our patients, we came up with this idea really collectively. And the group was designed to bring young training physicians into a situation where they could learn about planetary health, specifically around agriculture and food systems. And they could use that topical knowledge and interest of theirs to do their quality improvement project that they had to do for their own academic program. Our hope was that this would in turn give them confidence in changing health systems for the better, and also grow a group, a community of practice that was interested in food and food systems and planetary health. So that would be the main goal.
That sounds like a very laudable goal, and I'm sure you're sticking to it. Now, to establish a certain street cred for you, Valerie, as part of a long-time dream, you became a proud farm owner in 2013, bought a 68-acre heritage farm with 13 acres in pasture and a large vegetable garden. And I presume the rest is in forested cover of some sort, is it? Yeah.
Bush, as it's called.
Yes, bush. Yes, I know that it's a term that covers a multitude of virtues. The thing about it was that you didn't really have any experience in farming. So why don't you describe how your neighbor and others rescued you from this pall of unawareness? What happened?
So it was really extreme unawareness, I would say, and combined with a blind hope that I would actually learn how to farm. So my next door neighbor was an experienced farmer, and he agreed to mentor me.
And he was no spring chicken.
No, he was in his 70s. So yeah. And he was, I think, amused by the doctor who wanted to be a farmer, because really, I guess, not a common sight.
And he taught you things like how to feed a pig. Why don't you describe the process of learning how to feed a pig?
Well, okay, so I would offer that no one in this group, unless they grew up on a farm, knows how to feed a pig. How much do you feed a pig? When do you feed a pig? How do you know when they're full? Because they can't really tell you that.
They don't know.
Pigs like to eat, and they'll eat, and they'll keep eating. So you have to use two ice cream containers twice a day, or whatever it takes them 15 minutes to eat. That's how you know they're getting enough.
That sounds intensely scientific. I think there's a paper in there. There's a paper in there somewhere, how to feed a pig.
Because pigs can't just eat grass, right? They're like us, they're omnivores. They've got to eat some sort of protein and grains. So this is like a sort of a grain mix that they eat with some amino acids and some vitamins.
The other thing that helped you a lot was that your neighbors, not just the one neighbor, but other neighbors as well. There's something about a rural setting where people are growing things that kind of draws people together to try and help one another.
Yeah, it really was. Like, so first of all, there was an organization that you could take a course with if you weren't a farmer, and you'd go for 7 weekends and develop a farm plan. And that was a volunteer, like a not-for-profit organization that you took the course with. So I did that.
Was that the Farm Start program?
Yeah, I would go to Guelph on Saturdays and learn how to be a farmer. And and then there was trying to find on the ground help, which was, you know, the neighbor at first, and then later ended up being a retired school teacher. And then the neighbors themselves were all either amused or helpful or both.
Or they had pity. They had pity on you.
Yeah. I mean, I had one guy who was a wonderful mentor to me and many other people, and he, you know, taught you how to repair a fence. And he also said, make sure you lean on your fence post once in a while and look at the farm, because that's important too.
You have a century barn. It's a century property, is it not? That's a unique feature. It's only in Ontario, I believe. I looked it up, and it seems to be Ontario and the United States. And what does that mean, a century barn? I mean, it's kind of obvious in a way, but...
So it's, I think it means it's at least 100 years old, and it's usually built from the logs harvested on the property. And some of those logs are pretty big. I mean, David's seen them. He can testify to that. And it's very beautiful. It's a really beautiful place to sit and enjoy the, you know, afternoon sun coming through the barn boards.
And you were told that you had to have living creatures in the barn to keep it healthy.
Yeah, so the heritage barn people who came said barns are living buildings, which means if you don't put animals in them in the winter, they freeze and thaw and get damaged more quickly. So the barn is really, like everything, interconnected with the animals, and they are kind of have developed together, right? So the animals keep it warm, and the barn keeps them warm. So,
and you must. And maybe everybody in your group knows about Gertrude the pig, but if they don't, it's time they learned.
Gertrude we raised from a piglet, and my daughter helped and will never eat pork again. She's coming home now as a retired sow. She's going to be just hanging out at the farm.
She's going to be a pet pig.
Yeah, pet 600-pound pig.
Yes, like, don't let her roll over while you're horizontal. The thing about your farm was that at one point, not currently, but at one point it was a real working farm, and you were producing some pretty substantial volumes of, for example, eggs. I think you told me 60 dozen eggs per week.
Yeah.
I do not exaggerate. That's an awful lot of eggs. And, it, you know, in some of the first comments I got on your guest information was that it's hard work running a farm. And I think 60 dozen eggs a week, you had to clean them all
by
hand.
By hand, but it was very meditative. I mean, it was long, but it was and the community that was generated from selling those eggs was very rewarding.
Yeah, it is. You create a, there's we live in a farming community here, and the relationship between farmers and their customers is really quite a lovely thing to see. It develops over time, but it's a lovely thing to see. Now, at one point you reached out to the Ecological Farmers Association of Ontario. I looked at their website, and it's a wonderful group, started in 1979 with one guy who was dissatisfied with learning everything about, regenerative farming from south of the 49th parallel. So he said, let's start something up. And how did they help you? What sort of input did they give you?
I think the things that I learned most, well, I would go to their annual conferences. And I mean, just from a selfish perspective, their food was amazing because it was all organically grown and largely plant-based. And then the advantage of going to those conferences is that we're incredibly smart and well-taught overviews of biology and ecology and how farm systems worked and how soil was developed and the importance of developing good soil for nutritive farming. And also they've developed a lot in recent times around issues around equity in farming and they have a large BIPOC group and a large Indigenous, specifically Indigenous farming seed saving group, and they're just so inspirational because there's a lot of people with a lot of different knowledge that come together and share ideas, and I've learned a great deal from them.
There's a phrase on the website that struck me, and it applies, I think, to growing sustainable physicians as well as to people on a farm. And the phrase is this: it's talked about walking each other's farms. And there's something about, I think everybody in the group has gone on the land with you and been on a farm. And if you haven't done it with Valerie, you've probably done it somewhere else, because there's something unique about actually being on the land.
Maybe I'll get Brent to speak about that because I think that Brent and David and Barry and well, everybody in the group has always felt it's really important to bind this program to an on-site visit.
Brent, why don't you say something?
I think we all recognize that for many people now, they're disconnected from where their food comes from, and they've never experienced being on a farm or being on the land. And one of the critical components of our project was to try and make that connection again. So we've run two workshops, one we did at a rural farm and one we did at Urban Gardens, which I think we're very successful at least getting our residents, first year family medicine residents, back out onto the land. There are many in this group who have a greater experience with agriculture than I do. I think my connection comes from the majority of my career in family medicine was in rural communities. Many of my patients were farmers, and they truly are the backbone of our communities. David, go ahead.
Well, I think the essential thing, one of the essential things, and is the fact that we have to demonstrate the connectedness between our food systems and planetary health and human health.
I want to talk to each one of you, get each one of you to share what your connection with the group is and how you got there. But first, I just want, Valerie, if you just lay out how Growing Sustainable Physicians was formed out of the Agri-Food Interest Group, the kind of the timeline, just so listeners have an idea of how that all happened.
Sure. So I gave a talk with Samantha Green at our Grand Rounds on planetary health, and one of my colleagues suggested to me that I should apply for a grant through our Department of Medicine, a grant regarding healthcare innovations to address the crises of our time. So I thought this was applicable. He thought this was applicable. So We made an application. We worked really hard to generate and review and sort the application. We submitted it, and you know, the only thing worse than applying for a grant is getting it. And then we got it, right? So now we had to plan the workshops and the evaluation of those workshops and the knowledge we're going to translate and how we were going to derive information to make them better for round two. So we went through that timeline. We started applying in letter of intent in May. The grant was submitted in September. We were awarded it in December. It started January 2024. We've been working super hard, meeting every couple of weeks since then, with a view to recruitment. And then the workshops took place in the late summer, early fall. And now we've got our participants who are going through their projects over the course of the year and will present those projects at the end of their academic year.
And is recruitment by word of mouth? People hear about you, and or is there a, or do you have a slick marketing program?
I gotta, you know, my recruitment program would have been a lot more basic than the one we ended up with. So fortunately, our members were instrumental, I'd say. We got a logo, we got a recruitment video, we developed a website, and everyone in this group has worked on that.
My sense is, just looking at the backgrounds of a lot of people that are part of Growing Sustainable Physicians, is that a lot of you have been doing things connected to planetary health, to food, to social justice. And once the word came in your ear, you realized that finally you had found a compatible location for some of those aspirations. Which leads to, I think listeners need to understand about the medical profession in particular, and that is that there is absolutely no training for medical students in nutrition and food. Now, anybody else know anything different? If you do know that there's a medical school somewhere that teaches about nutrition, please hold your hand up and we will give you the talking stick. But if you're like me, and I see no hands rising, we all know that this is the way it is. So my sense is that Growing Sustainable Physicians has come forward, and you've come to it, all of you, because you found a home for yourself of like-minded, a community, if you like, of like-minded persons, which organized training in medicine doesn't give, and nursing, I don't know about social work, Tasha, but well, I'll ask you that later on. So I'd like to now kind of go around with each of you and ask you about your trajectory in terms of becoming involved with a group, because every group is made up of people, individual people, and everyone has a different story. And I've heard enough about your stories to know that they're sometimes wildly different from one another. And that's a wonderful thing to bring to a group, a lot of diversity, a lot of different perspectives. So I'm going to start with the guy I know best in your group, because he was part of CAPE actually 30 years ago. And David Rosen was one of the original founding members of CAPE. And at that time, he was very involved with some of, you know, the things we had to do, like you're doing now, you know, organizing things, setting up standards. I think at one point you were involved directly with our other group for research. We had to have a foundation to take charitable donations and that kind of thing. But David, what drew you into Growing Sustainable Physicians? What was your path to getting involved with that?
Well, actually, it's as you say, we receive no education on nutrition in medical school, and I went to medical school in the 60s. Mm. But when I talk to residents at the hospital, they're not receiving very much, if any at all. And as I looked at also climate change, there's a connection. And as I read in a book on sustainability, for example, if you don't look at what livestock and food systems, you will never get a handle on climate change and controlling the rise of temperatures. Mm-hmm. So I was a member of CAPE. I rejoined CAPE 3 years ago, and It's a very invigorated group, now with lots more people and a lot of similar interests. And it felt really good to be with people who are of like mind, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you don't have to explain everything to them. You know what you're trying to achieve, and it's a parallel journey. Now, Brent, you said your background wasn't really in food and farming, but I do know that you were very involved with quality improvement programs, you know, in your career, and then you retired too. Brent, what was your track getting into the world?
So
I
started with Greta Thunberg when she started standing out on her day with her sign. Yeah. I started doing the same thing at downtown Barrett City Hall.
So why did you join up with a Swedish teenager? What was it about
because,
a Swedish teacher?
Because I really thought there's an example of someone who thinks that an individual can make a difference. And so I stood with a similar type sign. Then we started to hold rallies, you know, with several thousand people at shouting at City Hall. And I was raising my fist like we did back in the 70s. And then then we did grand rounds for physicians and all that sort of thing. And I kept looking for how to make changes. And I was a disciple of quality improvement science for 10 years, starting with Phil Ellis in the University of Toronto. And what they talk about there is every physician has two jobs, one improving health and improving the way we deliver health. And I thought, we now have to add another thing there. Physicians also have a responsibility to improve the health of the planet.
I think you said that you had a grand rounds and nobody came at one point.
Yeah. we invited every elected official, because there was election taking place at that time, from all the parties at all the levels, municipal, provincial, and federal, and nobody showed up. And that just annoyed me greatly. Anyway, so when I got involved with CAPE, I started to run into these people. And my interest in agriculture, yes, came from my patients who are farmers. But I also married the right woman who is a nurse practitioner who became a vegan and has moved me away to a more plant-based diet, dragging, kicking, and screaming away from that. So I've been my own quality improvement project, going from beef only on special occasions to no meat. And it's been a gradual, and it's actually been better for my health. I've dropped weight, everything's got better. So I'm actually a quality improvement project.
Well, I think we all are. We all are, Brent. I want to just move on, because I'm looking at all these smiling faces, and I don't want you. We'll come back to it at some point, Brent. But David, unfortunately tonight, Henry Svoboda couldn't be with us. He's one of the members, and I'll just read a couple of things that struck me. First of all, he's a professor of emergency and addiction medicine, which isn't exactly what you call an entree into planetary health, but anything's an entree if you want to be that way. But he also attached himself to the Cornell program that was run by Colin Campbell for many years. Colin Campbell is now 90, called the China Study, which is the most comprehensive comparison of Western industrial society's eating habits and the habits of rural, in this case, rural China, but certainly rural people everywhere, you know, kind of the indigenous population of China, if you want to call it that. And then he also had some connections to Guelph University, around the idea of diets and environmental impacts of diets. What would you like, because David, we thought you might be able best to say something on Henry's behalf. What would you say was his kind of part in the organization?
Well, I think there's good evidence that reducing meat, and specifically beef and lamb, are at the top of the list, and having an increased diet in grains and vegetables and fruit, that there is an improvement in diet. And one example of a diet, you mentioned the China diet, but the Mediterranean diet, which has been well researched, and it shows that there's decrease in heart disease and cancer, diabetes, obesity. So there may be other benefits as well. It's difficult doing research on diets, because they're often confounding factors. That's the basis is plant-based food. and with a minimum of beef, a minimum of lamb, and a minimum of fish and eggs and dairy products.
Henry has a wonderful lecture about this where he teaches us all about plant-based eating, and we've really all learned a great deal. Among us, there are people who have been vegan for a long time. So some of us are just learning, basically.
Yes, yeah, so the word you used to describe his lecture was stunning. What I wanted to add was that there seemed to be a direct connection between the kind of work that Henry is doing, talking about, and I believe Tila, you've also been involved in this, talking directly about how to eat, you know, how to eat a plant-based diet, not just look at have somebody serve you something, say, well, that tastes nice, what was that? We're getting rid of the old retired doctors, and Barry Bruce, you're the third in that list. Well, what is the Deep Roots Food Hub? That right. Sounds like an interesting organization.
It grew out of something that I ran for a few years called Rural Healthy Living. My wife and I started a practice in 1973 in Carp, Ontario. And that's a rural area. It was underserviced at the time. And later on, I got more involved with, I suppose, preventative medicine, equally with curative medicine, obviously. And we looked for ways of improving patients' health by increasing exercise, by looking at their nutrition, and so on. That grew into an organization called Deep Roots Food Hub. It was started with being run by other people, thank goodness. And we applied for a grant and actually got a huge grant, $125,000, to build a root cellar, an off-grid root cellar, and also to deal with food security in West Carleton. West Carleton was considered to be a food desert at the time.
It sounds so subversive, a root cellar, an off-grid root cellar.
It is. And I think probably if we're going to transform agriculture, we need to be subversive.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure we're going to counter it by going head to head and convincing industrial type farmers to change unless we give them an alternative.
What about involvement with Barry with Growing Sustainable Physicians? Did this marketing campaign that Valerie was describing reach you, or were you looking for some place to attach yourself?
I think I was a member of CAPE, and I think
you just
we
heard
jointly decided to form a subcommittee or working group. I'm not sure how you describe it.
I remind listeners again that I'm speaking with 8 guests on Zoom from Ontario who are members of Growing Sustainable Physicians, a group of health professionals who are looking to link climate change, human health, and environmental sustainability into a nexus of issues to change the entire world. Now, so far, apart from Valerie, we've been hearing mostly from the men in the group. And yet there's abundant evidence that women are playing a pivotal role, and I mean that word exactly, in the transformational changes that global human society is undergoing. So now I think it's time for us to hear from 3 young women who are really, I would say, in the vanguard of planetary health initiatives. Now, the first that I'd like to talk with is Tasha Lake. You're the esteemed social worker in the group, but also I understand that you're the one who makes sure that reports go back to your funding source, so that there's a happy funder off in the background.
That's right. Yeah.
You're also studying for your PhD in a kind of course that when I was in medical school, or even when I was in any kind of educational process, there were no courses like this: climate change research and program evaluation. Now, why don't you for the benefit of listeners, describe what's involved in the coursework that you do in that program.
Yeah, sure. So my PhD is a PhD in public health. And so my coursework has been largely public health related. I have taken courses and I'm doing sort of a secondary diploma in climate change through the School of Environment at University of Waterloo. But it's more the research, I would say, that's more aligned with that. And so I'm part of a large group at Laurier, Ottawa, and the University of Waterloo. And we are a group of professors and all their students, and we call ourselves Northern Food Systems. And so everybody does research related to Northern food systems. So in mostly in the Northwest Territories. And so we have a whole range of folks on that team. So we have soil toxicologists, for example, and then we have me, who's on the other end of the spectrum, who is, you know, my background is social work and mental health. And so food that's, system, I guess, sort of like where I came from.
Food systems up north have become a major topic for discussion, often for political discussions. But one of the reasons for that is that the indigenous food supply has been almost completely supplanted by imported, packaged, sometimes highly processed food. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you're coming up with some interesting findings, and you and your colleagues are coming up with some interesting findings around that peculiar, abnormal situation.
Yeah, certainly the work that we do is community-based, community-driven, and I really like that aspect of it. It's very participatory. So people do things like help build community gardens or create food mapping systems between communities so food sharing can happen more easily in communities, things like that. That isn't really what I'm doing, though. I'm really sort of wildfire and mental health and more psychosocial impacts. And so last summer when Yellowknife was evacuated, I was in Yellowknife actually doing an evaluation with the Yellowknife Farmers Market. And
you didn't realize you were doing in-kind research. You
exactly.
were an embedded researcher.
That's right. Yeah.
Good Lord.
And so I think,
was it scary, Tasha? Was it a bit scary?
I would say yes, it was. And I was also in the Northwest Territories in 2014 in the previous worst wildfire season. And it wasn't scary then because we didn't know as much in 2014 as we do now, or as we did in 2023. And there was an illusion that Yellowknife would be safe, I think. And when there's only one road to get into a community or out of a territory, it becomes really challenging. And so I think some of the things that were quite concerning were some of the community-based organizations I was working with having to ration food for their clients. And there aren't great food storage systems. So those are some of the concerning things I think that were coming up during that particular time.
One of the jobs that you do with Growing Sustainable Physicians is helping keep, as I mentioned earlier, keeping on track with the funders and also doing some of the digital kind of communication stuff. That seems to be a forte that you have taken on.
Truly, neither one of those things I feel like are really a strength of mine. But Brent, I think, has really helped me a lot with the keeping everyone on track. So Brent and I really, really do that together. I guess we're a good accountability team.
Brent chairs the meetings and you keep track of the numbers and things.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And I like the evaluation. So I designed the evaluation and have been gathering all the, you know, the data for the evaluation. And that's sort of the piece, I think, right. I guess, well, like the strength that I've brought to the team.
Feedback to somebody who's opening their wallet is always a good thing. It makes them like to keep their wallet open.
Yeah.
I want to talk a little bit now to another one of your colleagues in the group, and that's Serena Zara. Serena, you're in a position at the beginning of your career in the medical world, and that's always an interesting place to be. I can have lots of memories from that from my own experience. But you started out as a summer student and you stayed on with the group. And I think that's interesting. What was it that kept you going with the group? What kept you involved?
Yeah, so, you know, like a lot of students, I was thinking about, oh, what am I going to do with my summer? And I came across this very interesting project and met with Dr. Palda, Valerie, and everybody else.
Why was it interesting to you, Serena?
It was interesting to me because I realize, I mean, it's a silly thing, but I mean, everybody eats. Food is an integral part of everybody's day to day. And, you know,
there's a lot of nodding heads when you said that, by the way.
If I'm, you know, one day going to talk to patients about their diets and about their health and how what they're putting in their body impacts how they feel, I figure I might as well, you know, at least know something about it. And, you know, you look on the news, you look online and you see how not only food, but just the how the climate is changing and how the world is changing. And it makes me think, you know, that is something that my generation and the generations afterwards are going to live through and experience. And we need to be prepared for it. And so I thought, you know, what better way to start than with this project? And, you know, it's just through the mentorship in this group and what I've learned, it's become so important and just so innovative, I think, that I figured, you know, I have to stay on and see where this thing goes.
Valerie, you would like to add a comment?
I would like to say that we actually need Serena very badly to help us with our digital presence, website, and,
so she's...
and yes, communications. So we kind of also begged her to stay us.
Well, getting down on your knees once in a while, as long as you can get up afterwards, is not a bad thing to do. Serena, what would you say involvement with this group, Growing Sustainable Physicians, has done to you in terms of where you're going to go in your medical future? Do you have any thoughts about that?
Yeah, I think it's really made me think about how I, in my career, will relate, you know, not only to my patients, but to the world around us and how that's constantly changing. I mean, you know, 10 years ago, growing up, like, we knew climate change was a thing. I remember learning about the greenhouse gas effect and all those things. But now, like, we're really, you know, seeing the effects, like with the forest fires that Tasha mentioned in Yellowknife, and, you know, just the hurricanes and storms that we were having in Florida. Like, it is here. It's a real thing. We can't really, you know, kind of turn a blind eye anymore. And so it's important to take some consideration. And I'm sure I'm going to encounter at some point in my future career patients who are affected by what's going on, not only with the climate, with their food sources, all these things. And I'd like to be in a position where I'm of, you know, some help and can direct them to, you know, how we can help rectify this issue.
You'll be familiar with the issues. I'm wondering if you have a sense of anxiety from time to time, or maybe underlying you in a lot of times, about how the future will be, given the climate issue and pollution and social justice, inequity, all of these things are looming pretty large. What does that feel like?
Yeah,
for you?
Yeah, it's a little existential crisis. I kind of like to think about it. And I have a lot of these discussions with my peers and with my colleagues who are at a similar level of training and kind of what we're going to do to tackle this issue, because I think it is going to be one of the big things that we'll have to face in our careers. And it's a very daunting issue because no one has an answer. And it's not a simple answer. It's going to take you know, everybody working together, contributing different things, because it is a very complex problem, as we've seen. But it's very uplifting and hopeful to see so many people wanting to get involved and using their talents and their strengths to contribute in these in these unique ways.
To be among friends when you're working hard to make something go better. Now, one of the people who couldn't be here tonight is Naomi Fraser, and she's a little bit ahead of you in her, she's in first family medicine resident. Somebody tonight who would like to just say a few things about her position. One thing that I was struck by, that there's a family farm in the background, the Hartwood Farm and Cidery. Have any of you been to the Hartwood Farm and Cidery? Because then you can give a, okay, Bruce, sorry, Barry. What's the cidery and the farm like? Is it a good teaching environment?
I think so. They brand themselves as being regenerative. The focus is more on cattle, managed grazing, and the lamas keep great watch on any predators and so on that come around. It's sort of funny. It's a farm that is only about a mile away from where I grew. I grew up on a farm in southwestern Ontario. So I know that Naomi, it's not Naomi's family, but it is her, I think the fellow she's, I think, intending to marry is one of the members of that farm.
So, a protagonist, yeah.
So Barry, well, you know how to feed a pig then, wouldn't you?
I do. I have fed lots of pigs. I grew up on a farm. I never got so formal as you've described. Cattle too, potatoes.
Yeah, pigs have been used in a lot of experiments on human behavior, like eating habits and physical activity, because their digestive system works like ours does. they have no control over what they eat. If it's edible and it's there, they'll eat it. Now, I'd like to move on to Tila. Tila, you've played, I think, everything tells me from what I know of your background, because of course, Valerie gave me a few little hints about that. You're playing a really important role in the group because you're bringing up other aspects of our relationship to food than simply the existential crisis that Serena was referring to, but also to the social matrix in which food is grown, consumed, distributed, etc. As a woman of color, you are very sensitive to BIPOC issues, which is Black, Indigenous, people of color issues. But why don't you talk about that? We haven't talked about it yet, but I think you're in a unique position to be able to lay out some of the issues that you think are relatively important in this kind of nexus of concerns.
Yes, for sure. I think that the current food system and the climate crisis that it is perpetuating has effects on Black and Brown populations, I like to say, both at a macro and micro level. So we're seeing at a macro level between different countries. The Global South is facing the brunt of climate change with, you know, infrastructure being destroyed, famine, flood, fire, and they have less ability and less resources to deal with it. So they're much
islands
more
being affected. Drowned, islands being drowned.
Absolutely. But we're also seeing that even if you look in North America, when the recent storms went through the American South, the mobile home parks were much more affected. So the people who were living in poverty, again, just don't have the infrastructure to withstand these types of things. And we know that people who are racialized tend to be overrepresented among those living in poverty. So that's another element of how, you know, the climate crisis in and of itself has sort of a racial undertone, where those who have not tend to be more racialized and are much more affected. And those who have are the ones who tend to emit more of the greenhouse gas. You know, we've all heard how one billionaire emits the same amount as like a small country. And we can see that through the other strata of income. And so when you factor in how the food system is contributing, and the fact that the food system, the industrialized animal agriculture food system, contributes, you know, some people say methane into the environment neck on neck with the fossil fuel industry. Some data shows animal agriculture is higher. Some show that fossil fuels are higher, but the point being, both are extremely important contributors of methane, and the chemical makeup of methane makes it much more potent in terms of trapping heat in our atmosphere, which makes reform to the food system so critical, and also a lever that can enable us to enact faster cooling, you know, faster on effective heating, faster off effective cooling, while we work to reform our energy system.
The an interesting point here about methane extraction. And I don't know if any of you have heard of Robert Howarth. He's at Cornell University, and he's a climate scientist and a biologist. And he has pointed out that the extraction and production, all the production features of natural gas, which is methane primarily, and the production of LNG, which is liquefied natural gas, is actually sufficient. All the leakage that takes place is enough to make the extraction of natural gas as actually somewhat more greenhouse gas productive than coal. Now, coal is often held up as the worst form of fossil fuel in terms of its effect on the climate, but it turns out that the methane extraction process, the shipping, the transshipment, the condensation into LNG is actually worse. And I think that's of grave significance, because south of the border, there's a lot of talk on both sides of the political spectrum about continuing with fracking. The other thing that happens, as you pointed out, is that people who are marginalized in any way tend to be in the communities that are often most harmed by extractive activities, whether it's forestry or whether it's chemical production or extraction of fossil fuels. What were you, in addition to working with this group, with Growing Sustainable Physicians, have you over time been involved with some of the advocacy work that I think is increasingly recognized as important to kind of change the systems that you were talking about that are inequitable and cause harm to those who are least responsible for creating those systems?
Yeah, I would say in a way, you know, I've grown up with an awareness of anti-Black racism simply because of my own identity. And so I've always been open to and sort of always had an education about those issues. In university, I got a minor in women's studies, and that includes a lot of topics in terms of race, class, and gender. And now as a physician, you know, I've been involved with the Black Health Vaccine Initiative, getting COVID vaccines into communities that might have mistrust for the medical system or have less access. And of course, working on the EDI committee at my hospital. And I'm also on the Black Medical Student Advisory Committee at U of T. So certainly, you know, all of these issues are interconnected. And I think that's sort of an underlying thing is, you know, you can't talk about food without talking about poverty, without talking about equity, without talking about history, because none of the way we live right now started in a vacuum. It all originated from somewhere. And understanding those underpinnings is really the best way of making a change.
For sure. Do you sense that there are significant attitudinal changes taking place, a growing sense of sort of we're all in this together, that the differences that we have been struggling with are really irrelevant, that we're all humans and we all have to work together, and people saying that and acting in that way?
No, I haven't seen that, honestly. Like, I still see, you know, the haves and the have nots, right? Like, even when you look at our tax policy in Canada, like the way we are giving tax breaks to, you know, super rich corporations and taxing people who are working, like, appropriately, I don't see that there's been that type of shift in our society in general, unfortunately.
Well, it's something we'll have to change. There's no question about it. And probably every one of us on this call tonight and all the people around us have to be working on that in a serious way. Now, there's one other person who's not here tonight, and that's Zara Kassam. Valerie or anybody else, would you like to give me a little bit of, she's got quite a history with plant-based diets, and she's, just to show that this is a motley crew, her background is in radiation oncology. And that's not something that, as again, I said with others, is a standard lead in to working on climate and diet and social equity. Anybody, Valerie, do you have?
I brought her name up because she is a member of our larger agri-food working group. Now, the GSP group is focused on a particular project based on some funding that we've received. But our larger agri-food working group is what I would say is our more representative group under CAPE. For people aiming to change our food systems and the way we eat and the effect on our environment. And she has done an amazing amount and quality of work in publishing these books that she has. So we look forward to working with her on our future projects. And I think that I think there, like, I would perhaps say that I agree with Tila in general, but I do think there are some really inspiring individuals, some of whom you're going to be interviewing later, who are trying to change our food systems for the better.
Yeah, I would say that the idea that getting to know your farmer, getting to know the person who produces your food, ends up breaking down barriers. It just makes it more human experience. And living in a small town, I don't know how clearly obvious it is in a large city, because I think I'm more aware of these issues in a small community. But you know that it's character, it's understanding individual personal development often makes a big difference. A lot of variation between from one person to another. But I think I would agree with Tila, there's a lot of work for us to do, and we have to keep doing it. Now, Valerie, I thought I'd kind of give you an opportunity to have a bit of a last word, because you're irresponsible for this group. You're creating a community of like-minded people by bringing together people within the healthcare system where, as we discussed earlier, there is very little official awareness of the role of food. I mean, it's growing, and maybe we can say that it is that it, that part of things is improving. But how is this community that you that is created, the community you call Growing Sustainable Physicians, how have you seen it evolve? I mean, it's not that long, but how have you seen it sort of progress over time?
Organically.
I set that up. I set that one up. I admit it.
Yeah, I think it's small steps right now. We're at the very beginning phases. We have six people that were that we would call our participants in our program. We are reaching out for partnerships within and without of healthcare to expand our network of mentorship for our trainees, and next year we hope to recruit more trainees. So, that old L'Oreal commercial, I'll tell two people and then they'll tell two people. We're kind of working on that principle right now. We'll see how long it takes to diffuse it out there and become an army.
Have you seen the powers that be wake up a little bit to the fact that there is a giant void in the training of health professionals?
In my own conversations, I have at the University of Toronto within my division and department, it's patchy, I would say. And but there are a lot of people working really hard. And I think the food one's a bit of a hard sell. Like, honestly, I think that convincing physicians that they have a role in diet and food systems might be a challenge for the near future, but I don't know if my colleagues feel the same way. Maybe
Well,
I'll ask.
I can't remember who said is we all have to eat, but
Serena.
given that we do, Serena, given that we do, it seems to me odd that people are concerned about advancing the health of individuals in the population would be kind of zoned out from an issue like food and its connections to the existential threats that you mentioned also, Serena. I wonder if we could close by just going around the group and maybe each person say what's been important for you in being part of Growing Sustainable Physicians. So I'm going to just go around the group. I'll just call out your name and you can say what it's meant to you, what's mattered to you about this group and you're involved with it. David, one liner.
Well, it's the cohesion in this group. There's respect, cohesion, and I think we build on the momentum from our fellow members, and it's a wonderful group to work with.
Serena, what's it brought to your life?
Yeah, I think the a sense of community has been something really rewarding and very uplifting in terms of handling these issues.
Barry, what's this done for a retired doc who's getting back in the stream?
Well, I think it reaffirms a direction I was going in before, and provides details as well. I think if I hadn't belonged to this group, I probably wouldn't have attended a 4-day course at Rodale Institute with 13-hour days just recently, and the The title of that was Regenerative Agriculture for Healthcare Physicians.
Very well, there you are. They saw you walking in the door.
Yeah, healthcare practitioners, yeah. I should say. So, yeah.
Barry, I'm just going to go on now. Tasha, you've been listening to all your colleagues talk. What do you have to say about what this group and participation in has meant to you?
Yeah, I think it's really exciting to see the hope I think that it brings, because like I have two little kids and I feel like I see hope in this generation of little people in everything they know about the world that I didn't know when I was their age. But then I think it's really nice to see it in the grown-ups too.
Indeed.
And I feel like so often don't get to see it in the grown-ups. And this is a group of people who are full of hope and
doing
want to take action.
Doing their best to be grown-ups. To be good ancestors. Brent, what's your thought about how the group's shaped?
I'm going to echo the hope and the optimism. We have a historical precedence that physicians were able to change people's thoughts around smoking and the relationship to health. And if you grew up in southwestern Ontario, you saw tobacco farms everywhere. And once we stopped people smoking, we saw a change in the agricultural system in Southwest. And I think the same thing will happen when we move away from meat and move to more a plant-based system.
Thank you. Tila, last
me,
word.
As Tasha sort of alluded, it's been the open-mindedness among those in this group, you know, going years thinking and living one way and being, you know, consistently learning as physicians are and having an open mind to new evidence. So I think that's honestly been the thing that's given me the most hope and what keeps me going.
Well, I must confess, listening to all of you speak and share your experiences and the diversity of those experiences, but the shared commitment to a pretty important project, changing how we live on planet Earth, so that we don't make it really tough for the people that come after us. And doing it with food, I found that every meeting where there's a little food being served, people relax and they become more amiable and they start to talk more freely with one another. And I think you could only be considered to be doing something really central to the future of humanity and our planetary home. So I thank you all for joining us tonight. It's been lovely to have you all here, see all your faces. It's been lovely to have you, and thank you very much for joining us. And I really wish you continuing success and expansion in what you're doing. Shared.
Thanks so much
project,
for having
us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Warren.
You're most welcome.